Hello, welcome to episode number 311 of the Apologue Podcast. I am your host, Simon Head. Sorry, I took a long time. I took a month off. I don't know. Oh, I do know why. I've been very, very busy working on this documentary on Lois Lowe, and I apologize for those who are waiting for a new episode. But here you are. There's a new one. And you know what? Couldn't ask for a better guest. Today's podcast is brought to you in part by AIXDSP.com. Get affordable and useful plugins for your digital audio workstation. Get the IC Intuition Compressor. It's a compressor that gives you a clear and intuitive visual display that shows exactly what is happening to your audio at all times. Click the link in the description for more information. Support my work on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/apologue. You can pledge as much or as little as you want on a monthly basis to help with hosting and gas fees, and you can cancel any time. There's a few price things in there where $2, $4 a month, it gets you certain things. Buy a t-shirt. Go to apologue.ca/shop to buy a t-shirt. iTunes, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the show, and please give it 5 stars. Like and share on Facebook by going to facebook.com/apologuepod. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at SimonHead666. Today, very special guest, Mr. Ron Sexsmith, who is a singer-songwriter dating back from 30 years. He's got friends in guys like Elvis Costello and Neil Finn, and is just a very, very accredited and esteemed singer-songwriter. He wrote a song that ended up becoming a huge Michael Bublé single. Just a big, obviously... And very approachable. I sent him an email or a text through Twitter, and he replied back. And I said, "Do you want to do this thing?" And he's like, "Well, I actually wanted him to be on this Lois Lowe documentary to talk about stuff." But he basically said, "No, I'm not really that, knowledged in the band." So I asked him to be on my podcast, and he said yes. And it's incredible. It's amazing what you'll ask when you ask and people say yes. It's always just such a great honor to have this presence on my show. Ladies and gentlemen, the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Ron Sexsmith on the Apologue Podcast. Know a lot of the same people, but we've never met in person. So thank you so much for doing me the honor of being a guest on the show.
Oh, well, no worries. Who are some of the people that we might know together?
Oh, Ron Hawkins from Lois Lowe.
Okay.
Who else? Well, I'm sure we'll get through it and realize that we know a lot of the same people. All that scene from the early 90s.
The Toronto scene.
Yeah.
So, and you're doing a doc on the Lois of the Lowe.
That's correct. Yeah. So that's my that's been my year and a bit of passion project to try to give them some sort of credit to where they stood in the whole scene.
Yeah, I remember one time, somebody told me they were doing a song of mine called "Tell You," which was. This from this record I did with Bobby Wiseman. I don't even know if it's true, but I went to see them at the Horseshoe and I couldn't get in. It was like a line up around the block, right? but there was a moment, right, where they were quite big,
Yeah, that first album really sort of struck a chord with the college scene and sort of independent rock and roll scene.
That would have been what, 92 or
91,
something,
92. Yeah. That first album, Shakespeare in My Butt, came out. And it's sort of like an independent record that sort of did really well. And it was in the days of like Barenaked Ladies put out a cassette and sold like hundreds of thousands of them or whatever it was. Like,
I think we were both featured on that show that Ear to the Ground that was on CBC at the time too.
I remember that. Yeah.
Rios were on there and everything. But anyway, yeah, so I'll let you, I don't know what, has the podcast started yet?
Yeah. Okay. We started. Yeah, actually, Dave Bedini is an old friend too. So from the early days of the Rheostatics and all that good stuff. Yeah. And I'm sure we know the same club, people from clubs like Yvonne Matzel, Elliot Lefko, folks like that.
Well, especially Yvonne. Yeah, she was always, good to me. You know, I didn't know Elliot as well, but I know, you know, and Cindy at the Cameron used to give me gigs and stuff, you know. Yeah.
So are you still in St. Catharines?
No. We moved. I haven't been in St. Catharines since, you know, I left for good when my son was born.
Oh, okay.
You know, in 87. And I lived in Toronto for 30 years, and now I'm in Stratford.
Oh, I saw F519, and I kind of put that. I thought maybe for some reason that was that area code.
Yeah. No, I mean, I did think about going back there, but it's hard to go back, you know. So we wanted to have a new start in a new town.
Stratford's a beautiful town. Beautiful town.
It is a beautiful town, yeah.
Yeah. It's fun. It's. I have a friend out there, used to be in a band called The Salads, Darren.
Who, I remember The Salads.
Yeah. They're a good bunch of guys. So you, I mean, you've obviously have almost a 40-year relationship with music and putting out records, and there's been a lot of, you know, a lot of, what am I, touch points to, like, your career or to live a life in music. One of my favorite ones is that I think I saw you play with Neil Finn at the Reverb.
You were there that night?
I was there, yeah. Both nights for Neil Finn, and you came on one night. I was like, holy crap, look, there you are.
Well, that was funny because I met Neil before. Because Mitchell Froom, you know, I worked mm-hmm. with Mitchell and we worked with them, but I just was, you know, I was still a courier at that point, I think, or maybe not. No, I wasn't. But anyway, he'd called me around dinner time. It was so last minute. And he was like, hey, you know, I hear you know how to sing Caroline No or something. And so I went down. We also did Moon River, I think. And it was just one of the, I think he had somebody else the other night. But I've always loved Neil. And it's nice to see actually them touring again, and now Mitchell Froom is actually in the band.
That's so right, strange. Playing keyboards. I mean, like, what better? The guy that helped write like all those great keyboard parts is actually, you know, there.
Yeah.
I guess it would have been Eddie Offert. Was that the name who played the original part of that first Credit House record? Eddie Rayner. Rayner.
Yeah.
So I mean, it must feel somewhat rewarding to sort of catch a phone call and say, hey, come on down and do this thing. I mean, that's sort of Neil Finn's way, I think, too. It was very off the cuff.
Yeah, and I remember years later he played at the Liberty Hall or whatever that place is on the water, and we went down there and saw him as well. But haven't seen him in a few years. But I remember I did a tour with the Finn Brothers when they put out that one album. And
Is that the green one? The green one?
I think it was a green album. It was the one with, you know, it was just Neil and Tim touring solo and then me opening. And, you know, because they were doing all those split end songs too on that tour, which was fun. But yeah, I mean, those guys, again, pretty much since my first album, they've been, you know, so it's so surreal. You know, growing up or when I was trying to get into music, I'd see their videos on the, you know, Much Music. And then, you know, next thing you know, you're sort of hanging out with them. It's kind of bizarre.
Yeah. So you as a young songwriter, did you hit like a moment where you went, oh my God, I can do this? Or like, do you have any sort of like epiphany moments, like when you finally realized you could do what you do and do it well?
Yeah, I did actually. And for the longest time, I didn't think I could do it. But it's when my son was born. I was living in Quebec, and it was a real emotional thing, upheaval, you know, because I was in love with someone in my hometown, but I had this other girl in Quebec who was pregnant with my child, who I didn't really know at all. And at the last minute, I decided to try to step up and try to do the right thing, you know, and I went to Quebec. And the night I got there, she went into labor and I had the son the next day, you know, so it was pretty intense. And I remember we were living in a barn and there was a piano in the barn and I didn't know how to play the piano, but I wrote this song called Speaking with the Angel, which was inspired by my son, who was only, you know, a week old or something. He was making sort of baby noises. And that was one of the first songs where I thought, you know, hey, I think I could, you know, maybe do this for a living, because I really wasn't good at anything. And then I started writing a whole bunch of other songs. And so for the first time, I felt the way I'd heard songwriters, you know, operate, you know, with all these ideas and melodies coming to them. And that that had never happened before. So that was when we decided, well, we got to get to Toronto. But, it, you know, we didn't have any money, so it took a couple of years.
Yeah. Now, did you train musically, or did you, are you like a savant, sort of just sort of knew how to make chords in your brain?
No, I mean, I had to learn. I did take some lessons, but I never learned anything from the lessons. I was frustrated because I just wanted to learn chords. So I would see people on TV and doing these interesting things with their hands, and I wanted to know what that was. So ultimately I bought Beatles book for easy, for beginners, you know, easy guitar. And I remember going, we used to go to Sabo Beach every summer, and I had a guitar, my first guitar, and I was sat on the beach learning these Beatles songs, which was actually a good way to learn because their chord changes were quite interesting. Yeah. And so that was kind of the start of it. And, you know, for Christmas every year, usually my mom would buy me, you know, some other chord book or something by somebody else. Or, so it was just, but I did basically teach myself. I think the whole other thing, though, the musical melodies or whatever, I think that's just in my DNA from the music I heard growing up. And just that part always came quite naturally to me.
Yeah. Knowing like musical language, like I've spoken to people who understand how chords go to each other and what kind of melody would go, natural melody would go over top of it. Some people just get that, you know, and...
And the other thing with me is, well, two things, actually. I mean, I played the bars for years doing cover songs, and I think that was a huge education. But also, as a songwriter, for the most part, I don't write with an instrument. I write while I'm walking around. So I'm not writing the melody based on a chord progression or anything. It's sort of free in my head.
Yes.
And it's kind of after the song is written, or when it's, or I have a verse or chorus, that's when I'll sit at the piano and I'll figure out what chords go with it. But because I find some songwriters, their melodies just seem to follow wherever the chords are going, which I've always preferred melodies that kind of lead the way. And most of my heroes did that, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Knowing, and how about lyrics? Do lyrics come out faster, or is lyrics a hard thing? Because usually it's hard for me.
Yeah, lyrics are the hard part. Yeah. I mean, I have written... lyrics just that sort of came flying out of me when I was, you know, maybe upset about something or whatever, you know. I wrote a song called God Loves Everyone with no music at all, but just the lyrics came out probably in a 45-minute time period. Sometimes people will send me music to write lyrics to, and that's not easy, but I find it kind of a fun challenge. If lyrics were easier, or if I had a lyricist, I probably would have written twice as many songs, you know, that I have. So
it's an interesting because there's a lot of people. I get hung up on lyrics. I mean, everybody seems to have. It seems like trying to explain things in a simple way to make sure your point's across. There's like this magic between message and words that it's really tough to. If you think about it too much, the bridge kind of gets destroyed a little bit, maybe.
Yeah, and that's it's a balance because, you know, a song like Secret Heart that I wrote early on when I was a courier, that was a song I wrote the whole tune on the job and had it out until I got home later that night. But the lyric is so simple, and I was trying to keep it simple because I'd seen all these other songwriters who could write these sort of 8-verse songs, you know, like Dylan with all these metaphors, and I wasn't good at that. But now, years later, like, I don't know if I could write a song like Secret Heart now, because, you know, it gets, because you change, you know, and things, I don't know, certain albums are quite, you know, lyrically based, and, but you want to get your message across, and you want to do it in simple language, and sometimes I'll hear other lyrics and I'll be kind of like, really, you're just going to leave it like that, you know? Because as a songwriter, I don't know if other songwriters like this, but I I'm quite critical of my own stuff, but I also sometimes I go, it just seems sort of half finished or not fully thought through, you know?
Well, yeah, maybe that's a sign that Yeah, because you have your code and standards of how a song, even doesn't matter what genre, by the sounds of it, it doesn't matter what type of music it is, should have a middle, a start, middle, and an ending, and it all should sort of somehow be encompassing, and it must be kind of, with modern music today, it must be very frustrating to hear, the kind of music that's put out that's successful, but I have a whole philosophy about that. When someone really says simple words, but they really mean it, I give them a pass.
and that's the other thing. There's sometimes this temptation to be ironic about everything, and and that can sort of sink the whole song, right?
Yeah.
I never shy away from a straight line or even a cliche. I think they're cliches for a reason, And but there's also this. A lot of indie music is the sort of stream of consciousness type of lyric, which sometimes seems lazy to me. Because it all sounds good, but then you wonder, what are you saying? What do you mean?
Yeah.
Obviously, there are people who are good at it, who can put out, this sort of collage of words, but it sort of adds up in a sort of poetic way.
Yeah.
But sometimes you're sort of scratching your head. That's what I always loved about Leonard Cohen, because he was a poet, but he used simple language, and you never were scratching your head, wondering what he's going on about. But also the songwriters who wrote the American Songbook, the Cole Porters and stuff. I mean, Johnny Mercer, they were just kind of geniuses with their sort of just how economical their lyrics were,
Yeah.
And how well they moved with the melody and in a very upfront way.
Were people, I feel like this, people back in those times of post-war, I think people were smarter back then. They had better grammar, they had better handwriting. They wrote better letters. There's some love letters that people wrote from the fields to their loved ones, and it's such beautiful language. And maybe that's a part of society, is we're living in this Mike Judge idiocracy world of where we're getting dumber and dumber.
Well, it was. Yeah, I've wondered about that. It really was an art form, and they were reading poetry and all that kind of stuff too. But also at the time, even those songs, I was just actually watching a documentary on Ella Fitzgerald. But even a lot of those classic songs that we call classics now were sort of, where people were kind of looking down their nose at them until Ella started doing these songbook albums, in the 50s of Gershwin, and it sort of, people gave them a second look, and they weren't so, corny anymore.
Yeah.
but to kind of continue on that theme, I used to, as a kid growing up, you would hear songs that were huge hits that wouldn't not be hits now, that had very thought-provoking lyrics and didn't have any obvious choruses sometimes. Mm-hmm. Songs that Jimmy Webb wrote or Laura Nero that were just really, for a kid to hear these lyrics like When I Die or, Galveston or whatever it was, hey, baby, do you like my body or this sort of thing.
Yeah.
They were actually kind of saying something, or to hear the Beatles sing Nowhere Man, that just blew my mind as a kid.
Yeah.
Just that whole con.
Yeah. Did you have influence from parents or grandparents when it came to musical education?
Kind of both, in a way. My dad left when I was two, but he left his records behind. Uh-huh. The records that he and my mom used to, the 45s they bought when they were dating, which were mostly 50s doo-wop and country. And I was allowed to play them, mm-hmm. So that was a huge influence. But also, I remember I was really close with my grandmother, and she was a huge fan of Bing Crosby. That was her favorite singer. And so I kind of got into him at an early age. And he was singing, he was kind of the first guy to sing those songs, so that we call, the standards or something. But mostly I would say from my mom and dad's records and the radio, which I still feel lucky to have grown up in the, mid 60s, early 70s period, where everything was so melodic and just sounded magical to me.
It's such a revolution on music and technology and and songwriting and business, everything early 70s. I was born in 1970, so I only know this just by reading up on it. But just so how, like, I'm honestly, we went from Beatles in 64 to the Beatles in 1970. Anything in between there, like the Kinks, the Stones, all this music just coming at people in such a fury. Jimi Hendrix, like, you know, you think about that. Led Zeppelin, like, it's like, when have we gotten that? Like, I mean, I'm sure that we've had our little revolutions of music throughout the years, but my parents saw the Beatles in a park in England for 35 minutes. You know, it's like, that's something I just found that out, by the way. It's like, really? Yeah. That would have been something worth mentioning, you know?
Well, it was a real, that, you know, Renaissance period. And, but also, I mean, there were all those bands, obviously, but there's just even the one hit wonders you would hear back then or something, you know, you would hear these, I don't know, or not even one hit wonders, but groups like, you know, Badfinger had a few hits or Bill Withers. I loved, Dionne Warwick and all those Bacharach songs I would hear on the radio. Gilbert O'Sullivan was another guy that I liked as a kid.
Alone Again, Naturally.
And he had like, I guess, three or four hits, but, cause you wouldn't hear, you know, you wouldn't hear Led Zeppelin really on the radio.
Yeah, but
they were one of the first bands to be enormous without having any hits, you know, like, and it was, and even Pink Floyd was like that too.
Definitely.
That was also the era of the album artist, and even Elton John, who had tons of hits, I've always considered him an album artist, and, you know, where the album cover looked the way the music sounded, and there was kind of a cohesiveness to it.
Yeah.
I've always tried to do that with my stuff, and, but, you know, there wasn't as much competing for your attention back then. It was, you know, if someone had an album out, generally you would know it. Same way if someone had a movie out or if there's a new TV show.
Yeah.
Because there's only like four channels or something.
Also when Zeppelin came to town, that was a real thing. Like, people were like, yeah, maybe I'll go see Led Zeppelin. You know, well, I would like to meet those people who like, yeah, I miss seeing Led Zeppelin because the Love Boat was on or something. I don't know. But.
Yeah, well, the other thing, you know, you could be a group like Led Zeppelin or like the Rolling Stones, for example, did a tour. I remember which album. It might have been for the Black and Blue album or something. They didn't spend a dime on promotion. It was all word of mouth. It was just like, you know, all the Stones are coming, and every arena was sold out. So, I mean, there's still a word of mouth element even today to certain things. But, you know, and I'm 57 now, so I feel some ways like a relic, you know, or a dinosaur. But it's just sort of amazing. For a guy who hasn't sold many records, that I'm still kind of in the game, it's kind of amazing.
Yeah. Like, how did you navigate yourself through the 90s into the 2000s when the record industry broke apart? Like, how did you sort of get yourself through that? Because you came out at the other end, you know, obviously.
Well, I was sort of fortunate to be signed at the kind of tail end of the record industry when they were still throwing money around. And I got this major label deal in LA, which no one was more surprised than I was, you know, to get not only a record deal, but with the biggest label in the world at that time, which was Interscope. And I think a lot of the industry up in Canada were kind of, you know, just surprised by that because they had all turned me down about three times. And so it felt, you know, I remember I signed, I think it was an 8-album deal, and I was just sort of coasting along because there was this idea that you could be a, what they called a cred artist. If, you know, if you didn't sell very well, but the critics liked you, you could sort of coast on the success of the other artists on the label, you know? But after, you know, I guess around my third album, it all started changing, and Interscope merged with Geffen and A&M, and I became less and less of a priority there. And so by the time my fourth album came out in 2001, they had paid for it, but they didn't put it out, and I had to shop it around. And we found, you know, since then I've been sort of bouncing around from different labels, you know. So it's, but I just feel lucky I got in the door. And I was able to establish a bit of an international following before it all went down the drain, you know, the industry.
Yeah. Yeah. There used to be a time when the label would go 7 or 8 records deep, but not expect any sort of payback until at least the second or third, when they could actually develop a band.
That's what they would say to me. Like, yeah. I remember talking to the president when I heard they were going to let me do a 4th album. You know, I was kind of surprised. And they said, well, you know, with someone like you, you never know when you're going to hit it out of the park, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's funny because the album, which was Blue Boy, the one they made it, but they decided they wouldn't put it out. That was sort of, from a sales perspective, the most successful one, you know, and at least in America. And yeah. So, but it's been kind of a strange journey, because then there were times where I thought, well, I'm never going to get another record deal. But then my manager was always able, there was sort of enough interest in what I was doing that I could always get, you know, I was on network for a while, and I was, I've been on Warner now in Canada since 2004.
Yeah. And you're on the same label as Lois and Low.
What's that? Sorry.
They put out some records on Warner Brothers, Lois and Low.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
With Steve Kane. You know, I've been on this other label called Cooking Vinyl, and based out of the UK for almost as long. So I felt relative stability since, you know, mid 2000s.
Yeah. Now, do you, you obviously have a worldwide following and people, do you write with your fans in mind? Like, that's maybe a stupid question, but do you write with like, hey, this is what people are expecting? Or do you just sort of get into a room and just start making stuff up and then here it is, love it or hate it?
Yeah, no, I never think about any one really when I write. Yeah. I mean, sometimes it occurs to me, you know, when I have a bunch of songs written, you know, it'll occur to me that, oh, this is, you know, this is kind of what people like from me, you know, or this is the sort of thing that I'm known for, I guess, or whatever. Yeah. But I don't try to do that. It's just, but once I make the record, I'm always thinking, oh, this is the one they're all going to hate or something.
Okay.
But so far, you know, I think the people are into me. Yeah. You know, they know that I'm the sort of the intentions are good. And because I'm just, like I say, I'm an album artist and I'm trying to make albums that kind of stand alone. So, like, for example, I just sort of finished recording a new album. And I don't know what it's like for other people, but every album you make or I make, I always think, oh, this is my best one. Yeah. And I think if I stop thinking that, then maybe I should just pack it in.
Yeah, that's yeah. So sort of the question leads up to like, do you sort of have like an era of time that you wrote a certain way that you maybe reflect back on? So like, hey, I wrote this way 20 years ago. Maybe let's try to write in this vein, or do you just open up your mind, let stuff come out of it?
Yeah, I don't really look back too much on. You know, sometimes I hear an old song, again, like Secret Art, where I think, oh, I don't know if I could write that now, or I would have maybe ruined it by getting too fancy or something, you know.
Yeah.
I just try to keep moving forward. Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago on my birthday, I was alone. My wife was in Hawaii for a week or something, and I never listened to my own records, but I remember thinking, All this week, I'm going to listen to, you know, each night, 2 albums of mine in the order that they came out. And just, I don't know, I just was sort of feeling like I wanted to hear them and wanted to make peace with them or something. Mm. And it was kind of really good for me to do, because it brought back all these memories. And yeah, not everything worked out, not everything. You know, sometimes the singing was bad, or sometimes the production wasn't right. But you know, ultimately they kind of turned out the way they were supposed to, I think. And the people, you know, everyone seems to have a different favorite one, you know, and so it's not really for me to say, mm-hmm. which one is good or which one, you know, didn't quite work out.
Well, I guess that's the sign of success too, that, you know, and sort of rest on like, well, here's a record I put out when I was 30 and here's a record I put out when I was 20.
Yeah.
They stand on their own, and that's what people who love your music so much, they agree with that. So, I mean, you know, it does have that to me is a form of success, because if someone said, yeah, I kind of like this record way more than all the other records, then that to me, it's almost like a short-term gain and a long-term loss, because you want people to come along the ride with you, right?
Yeah, and I'm the same way with the artists that I admire, that I listen to their records. I love a lot of, I'm always curious to hear, like, you know, a big Lifa fan. I love a lot of the records he made in the 80s and 90s, and yeah. No one ever seems to talk about those ones. But I'm always interested to hear what, if there's a trust that is established when you love a certain artist, and so whenever they get around to making a record, it's very, you know, you want to hear what they have to say or what they're going through, or and you want to hear how their voice is aging or all these other things. So I think, you know, that's what you hope for when you have a career. You hope that the audience is along for the ride, for the ups and downs and the whole bit.
Yeah, Elvis Costello put a record out, was it this year or last year? And it's like it's time signature defying angry man rock. I'm like, how could he still do that? And it's still absolutely mind blowing how he can achieve that type of thing. And not, for me, it's all visceral, because his lyrics are just like, whoa, they're same thing, stream of consciousness mostly, right? Like, you know.
Well, I mean, yeah, he's kind of unstoppable in a way. Because, you know, remember with Elvis, you know, obviously people think of him as that sort of angry, you know, kind of machine gun kind of delivery, right? Yeah. But there was a so long period where he was making albums with Bacharach.
Oh, yeah, and, yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. I think he was trying to get away from that. But every now and then he'll come back and do a record like that, and all those people who are, you know, who kind of see him that way are always, you know, kind of amazed that he can still do it. I mean, he's just kind of a force of nature.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. You have a relationship with him, right? Like you guys are pals in a way, or have you?
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah.
I mean, I sometimes wonder if I'd even have a career if it wasn't for him, because he came in, he was like my hero in 95, swept in when the label was about to drop me and told everybody that was his thing that year. So that gave me a second shot. You know, we've toured together and we emailed each other from time to time. And so, yeah, so I've always valued his friendship and his, you know, advice and all that.
It's always nice when people go to bat for you, especially with art.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because you certainly don't expect anyone to. So when it happens, because everyone's so, you know, concerned about their own world and what they're trying to do. So, so he really did go to bat for me, and other people have as well along the way. And I never expected it, for sure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you must be doing something right, you know. you say please and thank you at the right moments, right?
I guess so. I don't know. I mean, I guess a lot of those, you know, the first people to kind of support me when I came out were sort of the old guard in a way, you know, like Elton and all those people. And that was so surreal for me, being, you know, club and all that. You know, I think it's what it is they could tell that I was trying to walk in their footsteps or something, you know.
Yeah, resonate your message with them, themselves, their own message.
Yeah, and I think they could see I was serious about it and I respected what they did. So even though I wasn't, you know, especially in the 90s, I wasn't connecting at all with the culture. I still don't really, but of radio and all that. I was getting the support from these people who probably wouldn't have been connecting either if had they come out in the 90s, right?
Yeah.
So,
And doing, you know, songwriting too. I mean, obviously writing Michael Bublé, right? That was must have been a career altering kind of like different path.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, that song was sort of a minor hit for me years before Bublé did it on my Retriever album. And I had met Michael, and I remember thinking, oh, if I could get a song to that guy, you know, maybe I could make some money. but I would send them songs or send him songs that they would never do. And then one night out of the blue, I get a phone call, and Michael's on the phone with David Foster, and he played it to me over the phone. And I didn't realize he was even thinking about doing it. And then they flew me down to Malibu to sing on it with him, which I still don't quite understand why they want me singing on it. But anyway, I did that. And, Yeah, and that record sold very well, and my publisher was very happy. And but that came right out of the blue.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, even Tom Waits wrote Downtown Train, right? And became like a mega hit. I mean, those are moments where you're like, oh, yep, that's kind of cool. I mean, yeah, I mean, let someone else take the obviously the praise to whatever the performance of the song, but it must feel pretty good. That's another form of, you know, something.
Well, look, Bob Dylan wrote that song, you know, what was it called now? But oh, I'm forgetting the name, but Adele did it. And then, you know, that, what's that country guy? He, you know, the guy with the hat. He always wears the hat.
Well, there's a bunch of them.
Yeah. but the guy that was big in the 80s.
Oh, Garth Brooks.
Garth Brooks. Yeah. Yeah. So they, yeah, To Make You Feel My Love, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, Dylan, it was just a song on one of Dylan's records, but then Billy Joel did it and everybody did it. Yeah. You know, you never know, really. And some people think, well, that person's not a great singer, so I can take that song and show people how it's supposed to go. The same thing with Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah, where everyone and their mom decide, oh, I'm going to do that song.
Yeah, there's the Jeff Buckley version that everybody does now. It's like
it kind of annoys me, actually, because nobody sings the original lyrics of that song. Like, I was doing that song in my local bar when I was doing cover songs, but there was a few verses that Leonard sang on his Various Positions album that nobody does, and I think they're great, because when Leonard Cohen re-recorded it on a live album, he changed those lyrics, and those are the ones that Jeff Buckley sings.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. And I think...
Yeah, so that always bothered me.
Yeah.
But then once Bon Jovi and everyone else starts doing it, you start to think, okay, it's time to retire that song.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny, because there's Katie Lang did a version that I swear she just took off Jeff Buckley. You know, even those ending high falsetto notes held in voice, that's a Jeff Buckley thing. Like, that's what Jeff Buckley did, and he did it in one take.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I you know, Jeff Buckley turned the world onto that song. It was sort of an unknown song, basically.
Yeah.
And obviously, Katie Lang can sing the phone book, right? She's such a great singer. So
that's true.
But I don't really have much time for anybody else besides those people doing that song. Sometimes I'll be at a party and someone will start singing it, and that's when I have to leave the room.
Yeah, it's like Stairway to Heaven at Steve's Music, right?
Yeah, it's like someone playing Hotel California.
Oh,
you know, again, you know,
a great
song, but I don't really need to hear it right now. But,
man. Well, I know your time is sort of precious, and you know, I appreciate you doing this, because it's, I mean, honestly, I just sort of texted you out of the blue over Twitter, and I don't expect anybody to ever get back to me. So,
I try to, on Twitter, I try to get back to people as much as possible. Someday I would like to get off Twitter, but at the moment I've just been, you know, it seems to be a necessary evil in a way.
Yeah. I read some of there was some Orange Face Monster tweets that I used to love reading that you used to tweet out. It was like beautiful, beautiful things.
Well, yeah, that was it. I mean, I'm actually worried he's going to get a second term.
Oh my God.
But that whole Trump thing was so disturbing that was my only way to, as a Canadian, to kind of fight back. But I often regretted it, because all these people would come after me and I'd spend the whole day blocking people, you know.
It's so polarized. I mean, I don't really talk too much about it, because it's like, I want someone to filter out the word, that word, like in all of Google. Like, somebody's got to develop a plugin. So when someone types the word, it's gone. Like, it doesn't exist. You know, like, it's not like remembering World War II and Hitler, right? We need to remember how bad things really were. But I think in this day and age, we have so much other bad shit to deal with. Like, we don't need to worry about what he has to spew. And, it's really changed my whole perspective. Like, I have friends down, like, in very left-leaning people, and I look at them and go, how could you live in a country when this fucking monster is down here creating so much havoc? Like, how could you do that? Oh, well.
Yeah, I know. It's. I mean, my wife's American, so it's sort of, you know, I have to deal with a lot of, you know, in-law politics sometimes. But I mean, hopefully it'll turn itself around somehow.
It has to. I mean, it's like one of those things. It's like, I don't know, it's the universe has to somehow correct. It always does, somehow.
Yeah. Well, I think Obama was such a genuinely good person.
Yeah.
That they always say the pendulum has to swing the other way.
Yeah.
That he was so good that I was worried that if it swung the other way, it would go off the rails and it'd be the worst horrible thing that ever happened. And then I was, my fears came true in a way.
Whatever.
I'd hope he, hope he doesn't get another shot at that. That'd be horrible. So.
Well, they almost had him fully impeached where he couldn't run again, but that somehow got overturned and.
And there's nobody on there that party will stand up against him, and there's nobody that can beat him either if he should run again.
That's trouble. I mean, it almost makes they should almost start propping up some Republican to somehow be able to, they should have a third party too. I mean, having two parties is essentially
ridiculous. One thing about Canada is that we have these other parties, so nobody can be super powerful,
It's either one guy or the other. You know what I mean? Come on. Like, we should have a choice. Whereas they're like Holland or somewhere in the Netherlands has 15 different parties. It's like a tenth of the size of Canada. I always enjoyed reading your tweets. It was like, oh my God, this is, there is no holds barred on this. I love it. It's great.
Thanks.
No problem. Well, I said, I want to keep it under an hour. So I really, thank you so much for doing it. I mean, you got my number, if you ever want to come on and, promote something and talk about the Beatles. By the way, that new Let It Be album that came out this year, I don't know if you heard it. It's unbelievable. Remixed.
I'm looking forward to the documentary this month. So yeah,
I think I'm gonna I'm gonna cry. It's like six episodes or something. I can't wait.
I don't have that channel, but our neighbors down the road do. So I'm hoping they'll let us come over and watch it. So,
it's Disney, right? Yeah, it's on Disney.
Disney Channel.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Well, I'll let you know if I have anything to talk about. But thanks for doing this.
And
let me know when it's going to air, and I could tell people.
I appreciate that. Yeah, it'll probably be this Monday. But yeah, like I said, honestly, thank you so much.
My pleasure. All right. Okay. Have a nice day.
Take care. Bye.
Cheers. Bye.
And that was Mr. Ron Sexsmith. Yeah, nice. That was an awesome... Yeah, to me that was one of those... Hey, do you want to do a podcast? I said, yep, next day we'll do a podcast. That's... thank you, Ron, for doing that. I appreciate it. It was a good time, and I really... I'm kind of beside myself. Yes. What can I say? Thank you so much for listening to the show, everybody. If you need to go listen to other shows that I've done, there's 310 more of them. So go back there. There's, if you're into punk rock, there's a lot of old punk rock stuff in there. Some friends, some movie writers, some doctors. There's all sorts of things you can key into and enjoy. I have a large back catalog of interviews done on this show. So yeah, if you like the show, please subscribe. Tell a friend. I hope that you all enjoy the show and enjoy the episodes I do, because it's long form conversation. It's not like reinventing the wheel, but I think it's what people are missing. People are missing conversations, and that's what this show is all about. So, what can I say? I will try to be more frequent with episodes. I apologize. I took a month off to reflect. Not even on purpose. It just happened where I was like, I just got to take time off. I was so busy. I travel around Canada doing this interview thing with this documentary and getting people on board for it. And yeah, it's been a struggle, but it's been super fun and rewarding. But unfortunately, podcasts takes a back seat while I'm doing this. So anyways, next week I'll try to get somebody on the show. Be good, be safe, enjoy the weather.